This is the Context Podcast. Context Magazine is a publication of the American Sociological Association.
Welcome to the Context Podcast. This is Didara Demir.
And Heather Batson. We caught up with Nancy Bates and Teresa DeMaio to talk with them about their article in the winter 2013 issue, Measuring Same-Sex Relationships.
In this article, the United States Census Bureau staff describe how they create new categories to measure relationships for the American Community Survey. This is an annual survey to gather information about the population and their living situations.
We talked to them to learn more about some of the behind-the-scenes work at the census. This work includes testing new questions and changing demographic questions or categories in the survey. We also talked about how they try to increase participation in the survey.
Hi, Terry.
And Nancy.
Hi.
First, we wanted to ask some questions about your role at the census, because context authors and therefore our podcast guests are academics associated with colleges and universities. So before we dive into talking about the family demography issues, can you tell us a little bit about the kind of work that you do with the census overall?
Sure. I'll go first and carry some time in. This is Nancy. So I've been at the Bureau for over 25 years, and so I've served quite a few different roles here, but primarily I've worked as a survey methodologist, survey statistician, and really what we do here is we don't work on survey estimates and the data that comes out of surveys so much as we work on improvements to the survey. So we conduct experiments where we try to improve our instruments or our question wording, and there's quite a few folks that have social science, sociology backgrounds that do that kind of work here at the Bureau. We employ lots of survey statisticians as well as mathematical statisticians. But right now, my current title is the Senior Researcher for Survey Methodology, so I work across directorates on methodological issues dealing with our data collection.
And this is Terry. I've worked at the Census Bureau for longer than Nancy. I've worked in basically the same job, but it's had many different names. Currently, I work in the Center for Survey Measurement, and I'm the leader of a group that works on pre-testing questionnaires. So in addition to the kind of research that Nancy talked about with where we do experimental things to improve questions, we also do pre-testing of a lot of the questionnaires that go out into the field. So we try to catch errors before they happen, before we administer the questions to thousands of people in our samples. And so we use techniques such as cognitive interviewing and behavior coding, and we evaluate questions before, in the demographic area is where my focus is, although there are people who do the same thing for economics.
So for our listeners who might not know what cognitive interviewing and some of the other techniques that you mentioned are, can you just briefly say what some of these techniques are that you employ?
Sure. Cognitive interviewing is a qualitative method by which a researcher or someone familiar with the objectives of the question conduct one-on-one interviews with potential respondents to the survey and get them to talk out loud and answer probing questions about the objective is to find out what are they thinking about as they answer the questions, and how are they interpreting concepts, how are they interpreting the time period if we're asking about whether something happened in the last 12 months. Are they giving answers that reflect the last 12 months? It's kind of a methodology to gauge the, I can't say accuracy because we don't have the true answers to people's questions, but to get their understanding of the questions and to the best that we can determine whether they're getting the correct information. And behavior coding is a different kind of a methodology which is employed once the surveys are out in the field being interviewed. Where the respondents are being interviewed. Interviews are tape recorded, and then a systematic coding scheme is applied to the interactions between the respondent and the interviewer, whereby we try to get information about whether the interviewers asked the questions correctly and probed correctly, and whether the respondents exhibited behaviors that are indicating a problem, such as whether they asked the respondent to repeat the question, whether they asked for clarification, whether they gave an answer that did not meet the objectives of the question. And then those quantitative data are summarized, aggregated over the questions to determine whether it looks like there's a problem.
That's very interesting. So have you used these techniques to look at a lot of different types of demographic issues?
I guess I would say yes. We most recently used these techniques in a test for the American Community Survey, which contains what formerly was the long-form census data. So I would say that that's a variety of demographic questions that were subjected to evaluations through this method. We've also used it to evaluate census questions, which in the last census was not just 6 or 7 questions, but we've used it in that. And we have used it in some other testing for other demographics.
We have a pretest policy here at the census, so anytime there's a new question that comes along that hasn't been fielded previously, we're required basically to do this this pretesting so that we get questions that we think are going to work in the larger population. And of course, in our article that was published in Context, we used this methodology.
Right.
You are talking about evaluating and doing changes in categories through these interviews and other techniques. Can you talk more about how you decide when categories or questions need to be changed in your census?
Well, I mean, we can talk a little bit about the categories and the testing we did for the items so particular to the Context article. So that one in particular had to do with relationships. And again, the article kind of lays out that we sort of were presented with a puzzle whereby we saw that the estimates we were getting out of the 2010 census were markedly different for the estimates coming out of the American Community Survey when we went to tabulate same-sex households. And so in the ACS, the American Community Survey, and in the census, the relationships, the categories that we use to put together the same-sex households are either a husband-wife, spousal category, or the unmarried partner category. And so one of the things we did was to look at expanding those categories. And the example, of course, we lay out in the article is breaking them out into opposite-sex husband-wife, opposite-sex unmarried partner, same-sex husband-wife, same-sex married partner. So those are the kind of things we would do with folks we bring into the cognitive lab, is we would have them go through, you know, the old categories and see where they would place themselves, and then go through like the new categories to see where they were placing themselves and see how they were interpreting categories and placing them. And then we would debrief them on what their situations were in terms of their actual legal partnership situations with their cohabiting partners.
Actually, I'm wondering, when do you decide if the questions should be changed or should be improved? Or who decides, really?
That's a good question, and it's kind of like I always say that this method is sort of an art and a science, because it is tough sometimes to really know when a problem exists or not. There's actually a good article that came out in Public Opinion Quarterly. It was last year by the lead author was, I think, Stanley Fletcher and Silver. Well, in any case, there was an article that came out that kind of addressed that exact question on, what's the maximum sample size you really need for a cognitive interview, and what are the metrics that you can really use to decide whether or not, this question needs to be changed or not. So that was kind of a really nice article that set some guidelines, if you will, because it really is sort of an open question sometimes. But I'll let Carrie, she does a lot more cognitive interviewing than I do.
Well, I guess before I answer that question, I want to get back to what I think may be the intent of your question. Are you asking about how you make a decision once you've done the testing, or how you decide that a question is ripe for possible changes?
I think the second one more.
Okay. And that's a different issue. I think Nancy kind of alluded to how the decision was made for the relationship and the questions that we tested in our researches in the context article. And that came about by looking at past data that suggested that there was perhaps a problem and that it's something that should be looked at. In other cases, I mean, I've done a lot of work with demographic surveys, which are not sponsored by the Census Bureau. They're sponsored by other agencies, and it's basically an agency decision whether questions need to be changed because they perhaps noticed something in the data, or whether there's new issues that come up which require new questions that then need testing. And an example that comes to my mind from testing we've been doing is bullying of kids is something that's very frequently reported in the news, and the National Center for Education Statistics has questions to measure bullying, and that's one of the subject matters that we're going to be doing testing on. And so it's kind of a policy area, and I guess that's how I would answer that question.
Yeah, another example, too, I guess I'd give. I remember the American Community Survey has recently tried to now get a measure of people's, you know, whether they have internet access at home. And there was a whole lot of testing that had to go on how do we, in a single question, convey, you know, what kind of, you know, do you have broadband, do you have, you know, wireless? And so we did all kinds of testing, and of course the problem was the technology was changing, so we get terms that we think would work, and then by the time we get them out in the field, some new, you know, technology would come along. So that's another example of something that we've got currently testing, yeah, trying to make sure we're up on the latest nomenclature.
Yeah, that's actually an interesting point, because when cultural change is happening very quickly, whether it's technology related or not, this process takes time, I imagine, right? So how long does it take to do a round of cognitive testing so that you're sure that you really know what makes sense to ask people about, and then to get it in the field to do the American Community Survey or another annual survey, from the starting that process to finishing the fielding of the survey? Like, how long would that usually take?
From starting the process of cognitive interviewing to fielding the survey?
Yeah.
I would say to do a good cognitive interviewing project, we don't always have this much time, but I would say you should allow about 4 months. And then the results of that need to get integrated into our automated system for conducting computer programming for the instrument. I'm not quite sure, but I think that takes a lot longer than the cognitive interviewing.
But don't you usually do a couple of rounds of interviewing, Terry?
Right.
Yeah.
And those rounds together, I would say, would be 4 months enough to do a good set of interviews.
And how do you choose these respondents for survey and cognitive interviews?
That's an interesting point. And I'll go back to the article that we did in context. The first set of things we did, the first method that we used was focus groups.
Mm-hmm.
And we were looking for people who were in cohabiting same-sex relationships. We were looking for people who had their relationship was spanned a variety of possible cohabiting same-sex relationships. So we were looking for people who were married. We were looking for people who were in domestic partnerships or civil unions. And we were looking for people who had no legal aspect of their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were fortunate in that in D.C., Virginia, and Maryland, right around here, we had three, well, now we have three, but at the time we had two different.
It was legal in D.C. to be married.
It was not legal in Virginia at all.
And then Maryland, I think, had domestic partnership at that time.
And then we also went to different parts of the country strategically to find people in different types of relationships. And we also went geographically to look for places where we thought people might not be as tolerant or accepting, and so we did some of the interviews in the South.
Mm-hmm.
But with the cognitive interviews, we also did the same kind of thing, and we did the recruiting for these respondents ourselves, but the contracting, the finding respondents, we contracted out with a firm that could lead us easily to gay and lesbian respondents in cohabiting relationships, because as you can well imagine, we were kind of looking for a needle in a haystack.
Yeah.
And they had a lot of data, and mm-hmm. so they recruited our respondents. We also looked for people who were not in same-sex relationships, but who were in domestic partnerships or civil unions, which we found in Nevada. So that kind of gives you, it's kind of complicated trying to figure out who you need to recruit, and it basically depends on the subject matter that you're doing the testing of.
But typically, I guess what we'll do is we'll take a look at the instrument of the set of questions that we need to cognitively test, and we just want to make sure that we hit sort of every category and every path. So that's sort of the starting point. And so, for example, if we're looking at, a question that's trying to measure intergenerational households or something, well, we want to make sure that we recruit people who live in those situations.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the term. So it's really very specific to the battery question that we want to test in terms of who we recruit.
Right. But it does seem like it could be complicated to recruit some of those specific paths like you described.
Absolutely. Right.
So one thing that you do address this a little in your context article, but not everyone will have read this. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about why it's so important to the American Community Survey to have an accurate count of same-sex partner-headed households. So can you, and you alluded to how there was an inconsistency between some of the numbers in other surveys. So can you describe these a little bit more and explain why they're important?
Sure. Well, of course, in any we pride ourselves in putting out what we call kind of official statistics.
Right.
We're sort of the nation's demographer, if you will. So it's not that these estimates are any more important than any other estimates, but the fact of the matter was, obviously, as society changes, there's been, policy decisions, legislative decisions, that are really keying in on this particular population, and we want to make sure that we're accurately counting them. And we did have some evidence to indicate that there was definitely some measurement error going on, because we had such a great deal of discrepancy between what was coming out of the 2010 census count versus the American Community count versus administrative records. And
mm-hmm.
we were constantly, as a habit, we try to benchmark and look at stuff over time and make sure that we think our estimates are sort of within reasonable boundaries. So when this popped up, it was kind of a real puzzle for us to try and solve, and that's what we sort of set about trying to do in terms of really breaking out the different components in terms of the questionnaire design differences between the different modes, and then doing the name and sex inconsistency. There's another article that we have out that really gets into much more of the detail of this. It was recently published in Public Opinion Quarterly.
Mm-hmm.
We might want to direct readers to a special issue that just came out last month, right, Sherry?
Yeah.
In Public Opinion Quarterly, that if anybody's interested in really the nuts and bolts, the context article was much more sort of high level and on the qualitative side,
mm-hmm.
but the other article really gets much more into the nitty gritty on the quantitative side of how we sort of figured out what was going on and how we ended up putting out what we call the preferred estimates that actually did change the number of same-sex couples that we estimated coming out of 2010.
So this might be beyond your expertise, but how do you think that statistical knowledge about same-sex relationships can affect federal policy? Because you did say that policy decisions are, you know, this population is getting some attention, and that policy decisions can be informed by accurate numbers. As demographers, do you have any comment on that?
Well, again, I guess my comment would be that, you know, things like health insurance, being on a partner's health insurance, these are measured through things like the cohabiting partner and relationship status. I think that's one example. Obviously, the stuff that's been going on in the Supreme Court, if they make a change, whether or not, you know, same-sex relationships are going to be recognized at the federal level, there's over 1,100 federal benefits that are tied to marriage. So there's things like, for example, Social Security Administration, you know, right now, same-sex married couples cannot, or you know, if their spouse dies, they don't get Social Security benefits. Mm-hmm. And so Social Security uses census data to model, you know, the number of people they think in a certain cohort are going to need or require Social Security benefits. And that population changes if they start to recognize same-sex couples. That's an obvious policy, I guess. Requirement of census data that you'd want it to be accurate, because that would change the models that the Social Security Administration would be putting out, and that would, you know, change, you know, what we think the full Social Security benefits are going to be. That's just an example.
Right. Yeah, that's a great example, kind of from the government side, that we might not usually think about from the citizen side, if that makes sense. So in talking to some LGBT people about the census more generally, I have actually some other questions. So I've talked to some people that have really strong opinions about the census, and some really want their categories to be counted, and some are more ambivalent about it. So, for example, I've talked to some transgender people who really want there to be more categories than male and female under sex in all of the administrative forms that the government puts out, including the census. Do you think that that will ever happen?
Well, I mean, that's interesting. The census does not, we do not capture sexual identity. We do not have a particular gender identity question. We just have, you know, sex, basically male and female. And, you know, there was a recent Institute of Medicine report that came out that, you know, strongly recommends that there be a lot more data, in terms of health data, that things like sexual orientation and gender identity be captured in terms of understanding LGBT health disparity. Mm-hmm. So the census, to understand the census, we don't set content.
Right.
We take marching orders from Congress, and if there's a policy issue or a mandate or some program need, then we certainly do our best to measure the success. Right now, there isn't a policy need that has been presented, you know, to us from Congress to say that we need to collect this information. If it arises, we will certainly do that. However, I will point out that Census Bureau does collect data from the health interview survey.
Mm-hmm.
That support survey is owned by the National Center for Health Statistics, and starting this year, they are collecting sexual identity questions just for the reason of, you know, understanding LGBT health disparities.
An example of what I was talking about before about the government agency, it's a policy decision. And when it comes down to the data collectors, we would do what we could to cooperate, but we don't make the decision.
Right, correct.
We also have some questions about the family demography. We're thinking what other changes in families and households have been happening over the past 20 years. Like, did you have any information about it through the interviews or focus groups that you have been going through?
Well, our focus groups are really specific to same-sex couples. There are certainly a lot of people in the Census Bureau that are much more knowledgeable. In fact, we just came from a meeting of people in the family sort of demography area who measure exactly what you're talking about. And some of the things they were pointing out, for example, that there's a lot more single-person households than there used to be over the time during the economic recession, depression in the last few years. There's a lot more doubled-up families, you know, younger adults coming back and living, things like that. But I don't think Terry and I are really the experts in that area.
Yeah.
We could put you in touch with somebody who could tell you, probably talk to you for hours about that.
Yeah, I think One thing that we were wondering is that if you've done any recent work about trying to help understand, again, similar kinds of things about what family categories are important to understand and for people to respond to, in addition to the same-sex partner families.
Right.
Like in the past.
In the past. You mean like how did we get to the categories we have now? Or looking forward, what are some things we might be looking to change?
Actually, looking forward, I think would be really interesting to hear about.
Well, I guess what I'll mention is there's an interagency group that was formed pretty much, I mean, not exactly in response to measuring same-sex couples, but I think that was sort of the momentum that got it going. And there's a report that's going to be coming out, and it involves, you know, the Census Bureau as well as, you know, a dozen other federal fiscal agencies. And while we spent a lot of time looking at same-sex couples, I think at the end of the day, we sort of at the end of the report say there's a whole lot of topics that we didn't have time to touch upon, and those are things like measuring, you know, more complex family households. So in this report, for example, we really concentrated on people who reside within a dwelling unit, within a structure, but we recognize the fact that there are other household relationships that, you know, you can have a household member who doesn't necessarily live in the same household as you, but they're providing support, you know, but either taking, you know, providing resources or providing, you know, care for a parent or whatnot. So I think there's probably going to be more research in that area, sort of understanding these sort of, you know, maybe non-blood ties in terms of family households and people who don't live within household territory.
Well, and I would just add one thing to that is that the people who have these non-blood ties, that some of that differs by culture, the culture of the household, you know, in an American Indian or other cultural groups. And that's something that the report doesn't really go into.
Right, but again, I think there's probably, if anything, it's going to be a second interagency group that will then try and sort of tackle sort of those issues and come out with some recommendations for new measurements to more broadly capture some of those family situations.
Right. That's really interesting, and the point that you bring up about how it varies by culture is really important, I think. Have you experienced more challenges with trying to get everyone to agree on categories that mean the same thing to everyone when there are a lot of different cultures at play that have kind of the same situation that, you know, you would consider them to be the same, but they might not agree on the name for it?
I don't know that we've come up with that so much in English forms, but one of the things that we see a growing need for is to test the questions in different languages, as well as our materials. The flyers and the promotional materials for the American Community Survey, for example. And in testing questions in Spanish, it's been demonstrated that they don't necessarily mean the same thing. That the word that was used to translate could have been translated into a different word that might have worked better. And that's something that we're really working on. We did find that when we did testing of promotional materials for the American Community Survey in Asian languages, Korean and Chinese, and I'm not sure if this happened with Russian or not, but the organization of the material, the way it was presented, was not understood as well with some of the Asian population, and it led to a reorganization of the materials.
I mentioned another challenge that we have is that a lot of people just don't really kind of recognize, unless you're in the weeds like we are, is that we have these different codes across surveys. So, you know, for example, the American Community Survey, we actually have four different modes now. You can do it self-administered on a paper questionnaire, which of course looks one way. We can call you up on the telephone and read a bunch of questions in the categories, which is really cognitively presented a different way. Come to your door and interview person to person, face to face. We just added a fourth category, which is another self-administered, which is the internet, which again is presented a little bit differently. And all of these really present sort of challenges, especially you've got a question that's got like a really long list of categories, like relationship does.
Can you say a little bit more about what your worry or what the challenge is about that? Like, what, for people who aren't survey methodologists, what is a possible outcome from?
So one of the things that's been very, very well documented in sort of survey methods is that if you have a long category response option, if you're doing it self-administered and you're reading the list, you're more likely to probably pick something that applies to you that's early on the list rather than reading all the way through the list. But it's sort of just the opposite, for example, or could be the opposite on a telephone interview. If the interviewer gets through the entire list, then you will remember the ones that were most recently presented to you, and you might be more inclined to present something that came later in the list. Or alternatively, you may not let them get through the list. You may interrupt the list, and they may not get all the way through. So those are just a few examples of challenges of how these sort of mode effects can creep their way into the data and how people respond.
Mm-hmm. Are all of these modes of administration available in all the different languages that that the census forms are available in?
No, I won't say that they're available across all of the modes. For example, I think the American Community Survey does offer a Spanish mail form if you request one. They can do Spanish interviews over the telephone or in person. Frankly, the internet, so new, I'm not sure if they have a Spanish language internet.
I haven't heard of one, but...
And certainly when you get down to the really rarer languages, you know, Hmong or things like that, we might have, a paper form available, but chances are we're not, the answer is no. We don't have it specifically across all languages possible.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly not for all forms, although for the census, we did have a guide in a bunch of different languages. We
mm-hmm.
had the form in several,
yeah.
But we had a guide that somebody could use to read the questions in many languages. But that's only the census.
So who decides which languages will this form be?
Well, I think it probably has to do with census statistics about for the prevalence of speakers of the languages from, I think, the two most commonly spoken languages besides English are Spanish and Chinese.
Mm-hmm. I actually have one more question. While you were telling all those things, I was thinking this is a huge investment too. Like, how much does this census cost actually, and who is funding it?
The 2010 census was the most expensive ever, and I want to say it was close to $100 per person when everything got sort of factored in, but I'm afraid I don't have a number off the top of my head.
And who funded it?
Most of the money is involved in the non-response follow-up and having to send a human being to your door,
right,
two or three times to get you to come out and provide information.
And also, isn't it also the advertising now to try to keep people from having to come to your door?
Well, we did invest in paid advertising, but I think it probably more than paid for itself in terms of increased mail return rate right now.
So you advertise about it?
Well, for the decennial census, the first time that we used paid advertising was in Census 2000, and then that was deemed to be pretty successful because, as you may or may not be aware, our profession is constantly, we're pushing a giant boulder uphill in terms of cooperation rates. They've been dropping over the last 20 years precipitously, and so that just increases cost because the harder we have to try and the more level of effort we have to do in terms of getting people to provide us data, the more expensive it is. So we decided in 2000 for the first time to actually employ, a professional advertising firm to help us come up with a social media, a social marketing campaign. And it was very successful in terms of sort of keeping that decreased participation from continuing. We sort of stemmed the tide, if you will. So we did the same thing in 2010 in
mm-hmm.
terms of having a paid advertising campaign. And it was... It was quite expansive. It covered television, radio, billboards, online, you name it.
Yeah, and I definitely saw that advertising, and a lot of it was targeted to specific subpopulation groups.
Correct, that's correct, yeah.
Right.
I did a lot of in-language advertising, lots and lots of in-language advertising. And we really did try to be much more precise in targeting hard account groups in terms of, you know, we had a, in addition to the diverse mass campaign, we also had a campaign that targeted African Americans and Spanish, non-Spanish as well as Spanish speakers.
Mm-hmm. How many respondents did you reach at the end after all those costs and advertising?
You mean in terms of what was the actual population count of the decennial census?
Yeah.
Is it somewhere 300 million?
Yeah, I would say maybe around 315 million.
And the American Community Survey is about 1% of the population every year. Is that what you're aiming for?
The idea is, I'm not sure what percentage of the population it is, but the idea is that you can get national statistics, you know, from this sample because it's large enough, and if you aggregate enough years together, you can get statistics at a pretty low level of geography for the entire United States.
Can you talk about these questions that you were talking about, the same-sex marriage category? The question is asked about the head of the household, or related to the head of the household. Since you talked about the culture, different languages, and these differences and challenges, what do you think? What kind of information can be lost in complicated households? Or, like, would there be anyone who is against the head of the household as a category, maybe?
Well, we don't actually use the term head of household.
In householder, right? So it's the person in whose name the house is owned or rented.
Okay.
I don't know that I have, from the stuff we did on this particular project, I don't know that it presented a problem. You know, we weren't really interviewing groups where that concept was problematic.
Mm-hmm.
I have known personally some friends of mine who put their daughter, for example, as the head of the household so that when they listed the people who were related, that they could say that both these women were mother, to this child. And they kind of did that to a point.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't because they didn't understand that she wasn't the householder, but they wanted the census board to indicate that there were two mothers in the house.
Right, exactly. Now, how the Census Bureau actually tabulated that is a different question, and I don't know the answer.
I don't either.
Is there anything else that you would like to say about either the work that you do at the Census or about the article that we didn't touch on that you think is important for listeners to hear?
Well, I guess I would just like to say that, you know, this context article and the questions that we've come up with, you know, we don't feel like we're not at the end of our journey. we're at the point where we feel like qualitatively these are pretty solid questions, but we feel very strongly that they need to be further tested in a much larger quantitative, context where we can put it out to a very large sample and really see if these things are netting what we want. So there's a couple of things that are going on towards that end. They don't quite meet all the criteria, but there's a test that's going on with the American Housing Survey that's going to field these new questions in both, I guess, telephone and personal visit. There is a self-responded test through the American Community Survey that's going on. It will be paper, questionnaire, and internet. And then the Survey of Income and Program Participation is using these new questions. And so by 2014, they hope to have a public data set that will show tabulations of both same-sex couples as well as same-sex parents. So there's some efforts in this area, but unfortunately, with funding, we just haven't found a nice big platform to go out and do a huge test yet. We hope that's coming down the pike at some point.
Right. So when the tests that you mentioned are finished in 2014 and you analyze the data, then how will you know whether it's kind of a good enough measure,
well,
or whether you need to do more testing?
Yeah, and the SIP's probably not the best example. It's more like if we will do these, when we look at the data from the American Community Survey test and the American Housing Survey, I mean, that's where I think we'll sort of get in and make the decision of whether or not these questions are working or we still need to go back and maybe do some tweaks. These aren't productions. This is just testing stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
It was really interesting to talk to you about both your context article and the bigger context of what you do when you do qualitative work for the census. And so we really appreciate it.